Good morning. I'm Anthony Noble and I represent the appellant, Lorena Rivas-Landa. The issue before the court is whether the district court erred in denying the petition for post-conviction relief in which Ms. Rivas-Landa claimed that her defense counsel did not investigate nor correctly advise her of the immigration consequences of her guilty plea. The district court denied the petition without an evidentiary hearing on the basis that Ms. Rivas-Landa did not establish prejudice in her petition, although the Attorney General has also addressed deficient performance in the answer brief on appeal, so I'm going to address both prongs of the Strickland test. There are two distinct claims that were made in the petition for post-conviction relief. One is the failure to investigate the immigration consequences, and then the other is the failure to correctly advise Ms. Rivas-Landa of the immigration consequences. The failure to investigate the immigration consequences is an obligation that's recognized by both our Supreme Court in Pozo, but also the United States Supreme Court in Padilla. And the failure to advise of the immigration consequences is something that was more developed in Padilla, but it's more of a natural consequence of the ruling in Pozo by our Supreme Court.
Counsel, does our record, or does the record in this case give us any insights into whether Ms. Rivas-Landa's attorney in the criminal case, and I don't think you participated in the underlying proceedings, so at least I'm not remembering that, but that that he actually communicated with the attorneys in the immigration proceedings and what information was conveyed?
Your Honor, the record shows at a preliminary hearing just after arraignment, I think, or at arraignment, that defense counsel did make a comment to the court that Ms. Rivas-Landa has an immigration attorney and that she tried to contact that attorney, but she wasn't successful in contacting that attorney. So what we do know from the record is that there was an immigration attorney there. What we don't know is what part did that immigration attorney play in the plea negotiations and the acceptance of the plea, whether that immigration attorney gave any advice to Ms. Rivas-Landa about the immigration consequences is something that we don't know.
Presumably that could have been developed if the trial court had actually held a hearing.
Exactly, Your Honor. The district attorney could have interviewed the immigration attorney, and then if there was information that she had that's relevant to the claim, could have called the immigration attorney to testify at the evidentiary hearing. So all we know at the moment is that there was an immigration attorney there. We just don't know what role that immigration attorney played in the plea negotiations. So what we have are the allegations in the petition for post-conviction relief, which this court has to accept as true. And the allegations are that defense counsel failed to investigate. That's all I needed to say in that petition for post-conviction relief, is that she failed to investigate. So the court has to accept that allegation as true. So on the deficiency prong, we've established sufficient facts that that there was deficient performance on the failure to investigate. The more tricky question is on the failure to give correct advice. The allegation here is...
Well, excuse me, Mr. Noble, before you go into failure to advise, let me ask you about failure to investigate. Under Padilla, does it make a difference if the answer to the question is an easy one or a complicated one?
On the failure to investigate?
Yes.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think the failure to investigate is triggered by the knowledge that your client is a non-citizen. So in this case, defense counsel had sufficient knowledge to know that her client was not a citizen of the United States, but then failed to investigate these immigration concerns that she was aware of, because she said at the hearing that there were immigration concerns.
Right, but assuming that the trial defense counsel knows or has reason to believe that the client has immigration concerns, does the defense attorney at trial have a further duty to investigate whether what the problem actually might be, or the immigration status of the client, to determine under Padilla whether the answer is clear-cut or not clear-cut?
Yes, I believe so, Your Honor. I mean, that's an important part of the plea negotiations. What Pozo says is that defense attorneys have to inform themselves of the immigration consequences of a guilty plea. Without doing that investigation, that research, a defense attorney is not in a position to correctly advise a client whether or not to accept a guilty plea. So I think that the allegation alone is that she failed to investigate the immigration consequences is sufficient to establish deficient performance under that that theory. The second theory is the failure to correctly advise Ms. Rivas-Lander of the immigration consequences. And as I said previously, this is where it gets a little bit tricky, because this is not as clear-cut as representing a lawful permanent resident, where the conviction is a direct has a direct impact on the immigration proceedings or on the immigration status.
In fact, counsel, where you're dealing with an entirely different situation in terms of a cancellation of removal here, right? So why isn't it simply the case that due to the discretionary nature of the cancellation of removal, that the defendant's deportation consequences were not clear?
Well, in Pozo and in Padilla, both our Supreme Court and the US Supreme Court said that counsel has an obligation to investigate discretionary relief. And the United States Supreme Court went as far as saying that, unlike the Attorney General's argument, which is that counsel only has to look at the immigration statute, the United States Supreme Court went further and said that defense counsel had access to numerous practice guides on immigration law. But to answer your question, discretionary relief is something that has to be researched and investigated by counsel and has to be advised on. And especially in the context of representing an immigrant who is here without being admitted, because they're not subject to deportation in the same way that lawful permanent residents are. It's not the conviction that leads to the deportation. It's the conviction that prevents any relief from deportation. An immigrant who is here without being admitted is going to be removed on that basis alone. So then the only area to look at is discretionary relief. Is there anything that can be done in the criminal proceedings to prevent that deportation? So that's where the obligation here is in representing representing immigrants who have not been admitted to the United States. If you accept the Attorney General's argument, essentially, Padilla and Pozo would only apply to lawful permanent residents. Any defense attorney representing a person who's here without being admitted would have no obligation at all to give them any advice or any assistance regarding their immigration status. So as I set forth in the opening brief, even though it's a different analysis when you're representing somebody who is here without being admitted, it's still the same direct consequence that because of this conviction, they're going to be deported. It's just a different way of getting to that conclusion. First, you have to determine, does this conviction make them inadmissible? And if that's the case, then they don't qualify to apply for discretionary relief. So the petition for post-conviction relief clearly alleges sufficient facts to establish that there was deficient performance for a failure to correctly advise Ms. Rivas-Lander of the immigration consequences. The allegations state that all she advised Ms. Rivas-Lander was that there may be or there might be immigration consequences. She didn't advise her that this conviction will make you inadmissible, this conviction will prevent you from applying for cancellation and removal. So the next question is whether Ms. Rivas-Lander was prejudiced by that deficient performance. And the only allegations that are required here are her personal circumstances at the time that she pleaded guilty. She was 12 years old when she came to the United States. At the time that she pleaded guilty, she had lived here for 15 years. She had three children who were all United States citizens. Her entire family lived in the United States, and she had no family, no friends in Mexico.
What role does a prior conviction play in that determination of prejudice?
It doesn't play any role, Your Honor, because the analysis of prejudice is whether or not she would have insisted on going to trial if she would have rejected the plea and insisted on going to trial.
Okay.
And under these allegations, her personal circumstances established that she was prejudiced, because why would somebody who came here at the age of 12 and has lived here for 15 years, has three children here, her entire family in the United States, no connection to Mexico. Why would she plead guilty to an offense that has deportation as a consequence? So the petition for post-conviction relief clearly establishes both deficient performance and prejudice, and I'd ask the court to remand for an evidentiary hearing. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Very well, Mr. Noble. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Erin Grundy, registration number 41271, and I represent the people. What the defense is asking you to do today is to expand Padilla's mandate to include advising on discretionary cancellation, to include advising on the unclear and speculative consequences of discretionary relief. The defense argues that in the case of representing an inadmissible alien, someone who is present without legal residency status, that it would effectively negate counsel's duty to advise. And that's not the case. That's not what the people are arguing here. What we're asking you to do is to look to the clear language of Padilla, to look to where it references that this is, that counsel's duty to research and counsel's duty to advise relates to the immigration statute. When Padilla cites to that, it references 8 U.S.C. 1227, which defines the classes of deportable aliens. Certainly, Ms. Rivas-Lando was a deportable alien prior to entering the guilty plea, as well as after entering the guilty plea, because she was present in the United States without being admitted or paroled. Padilla also speaks to referencing to inadmissibility. However, again, Ms. Rivas-Lando was already inadmissible to the United States because she was present in the United States without being admitted or paroled. This makes an alien inadmissible. So the critical question here is, does counsel also have a duty to advise on discretionary relief? And counsel does not. Now, POSA was decided in a different context. It was decided in 1987 when the Judicial Recommendation Against Deportation, or JRAD, still existed. At that time, certainly counsel had an obligation to advise on JRAD, because the practical impact of JRAD was that defense counsel could negotiate with the district attorney and speak to the court. If the court actually entered a JRAD contemporaneous with the defendant's sentencing, it all but prevented the defendant from being deported. But since 1990, that no longer exists. So POSO's discussion has been statutorily barred because the immigration statutes have been substantially changed. Padilla speaks to this. It talks about the historical evolution of our immigration statutes and how immigration law has changed substantially since the abolition of JRAD.
But isn't the problem here that we don't have a record that would tell us what conversations, if any, took place between, you know, the defendant and her attorney? And wouldn't a remand create a record so that the trial court can make a more informed decision and then so this court could make a better decision if an appeal is taken from that remand?
Now, it may have been better practice, but the people contend here it wasn't required because it was plainly refuted by the record. However, if this court were to look to a remand, then the critical inquiry needs to be, what does counsel have to advise in order to provide deficient performance, in order to provide sufficient performance? Counsel needs to advise on the clear and succinct immigration consequences, and that includes deportability and inadmissibility, but it did not extend so far to include eligibility for discretionary relief.
Why not?
If we look to the specific language of POSO, or pardon me, if we look to the specific language of Padilla, we see that Padilla was actually eligible for discretionary relief under a separate subsection of 8 U.S.C. 1229B. Because Padilla was a permanent resident, he was eligible under 8 U.S.C. 1229B, subsection A, whereas Ms. Rivas-Lando would potentially have been eligible under subsection B. Padilla talks about counsel's duty to advise, counsel's duty to research relevant immigration statutes, and it cites 1227. It never references 1229B. It never makes any indication that this is part of counsel's duty to advise. And it never references that Padilla may actually have been eligible for discretionary relief under subsection A because he was not convicted of an aggravated felony, but was instead convicted of a drug offense. For lawful permanent residents, it's a more lenient standard than it is for those who are present in the country without being admitted or paroled. So we know from the plain language of Padilla that it does not go this far. So if this court were to remand, the court needs to make clear that deficient performance can only be established by failure to advise on the clear and succinct consequences, but it does not extend as far as the defendant asks. Now, the Texas Supreme Court recently addressed exactly what an immigration consequence is under Padilla, which I cited in my brief as Rodriguez. However, we argue that Rodriguez got it wrong in one respect. They were correct in saying that Padilla does not define precisely what an immigration consequence is. But Texas was wrong to expand this to include discretionary relief when you consider the plain language of Padilla. The Texas Supreme Court relied primarily on the concurrence in Padilla. It ignored the majority opinion that actually provides binding precedent that does not look to discretionary relief. Pozo certainly doesn't tell us that discretionary relief is within the context of counsel's duty, because again, Pozo is decided in a completely different immigration context.
Well, Ms. Grundy, apart from Pozo and just looking at the general language in Padilla about talking about the immigration consequences, would you agree that what a defense attorney says regarding relief from deportation could have a significant impact on what happens to his or her client?
Certainly, it could have a significant impact on what happens to his or her client. But what Padilla specifically mandates counsel do is to advise on the clear and succinct consequences. Padilla references the very complex and integrated web of immigration statutes, which it also specifically references immigration law as an area of specialty practice in and of itself. Padilla does not stand for the proposition that counsel must research every possible immigration statute that may be impacted by a criminal plea. That's certainly not what Padilla can be read to stand for. And discretionary consequences of this purely speculative nature are not included in counsel's duty under Padilla. Now here, we don't have the best record. What we know from the July 8th, 2010 hearing is that counsel asked for a continuance in order to speak to immigration counsel. What counsel specifically said was, Ms. Rivas has immigration concerns. She's represented by counsel. I've tried to reach that attorney, but that attorney was not available when I called. When we come back for the actual plea hearing, we don't have further record on this subject. We know that counsel was aware that Ms. Rivas-Landa had immigration concerns, so was clearly aware that Ms. Rivas-Landa was not a citizen. We also know that Ms. Rivas-Landa signed the Rule 11 waiver, she indicated that she went over the form with her lawyer and that she understood the rights on the form. So, if this court were to remand for the deficient performance, the only appropriate way that the trial court could find deficient performance would be if it concluded that counsel did not make clear that deportation was a direct consequence of this plea. It could not find deficient performance based on the failure to advise on discretionary relief. Further, if this court were to remand, then the waiver under 18-1417 that's included in the 35C would need to extend to immigration counsel in order to make a thorough record on this case. This is clearly the issue on appeal is the immigration status, so the waiver would need to not only include defense counsel, but also to include immigration counsel. Now, in looking specifically to the prejudice prong of Strickland, Ms. Rivas-Landa cannot establish prejudice here. Certainly, this is a tricky, and this is entirely different than the status that was defined in Padilla or in Pozo, because Ms. Rivas-Landa was present in the country without being admitted or paroled. She was already inadmissible. She was already deportable. Her plea did not change that. We also see that the immigration proceedings in this case began before she picked up any of her criminal proceedings. So it is a different status than most of the cases that are cited by both parties in the brief, because most deal with lawful permanent residence. Certainly, that is an important distinction here. And in looking at prejudice, what we have to examine is would the defendant have rationally rejected the plea and insisted upon proceeding to trial?
Well, is that the only question that would be asked? And wouldn't it be appropriate to also ask whether the defense counsel might have been able to negotiate a plea where she would have pled guilty to a different offense?
No, Your Honor. A defendant has no right to crafty or creative plea bargaining. There's no indication here that it would have been offered, but even if it was the case, that cannot provide Strickland prejudice. We can't argue that every defendant could possibly have received a different plea bargain that may have had different consequences. That does not establish Strickland prejudice. This court recently addressed in Campos Corona, and as Padilla notes, the critical inquiry is whether the defendant would have rejected the plea and would have rationally rejected the plea and instead have insisted upon proceeding to trial.
Well, that's an issue on which you and Mr. Noble vociferously disagreed.
That's certainly true. And the reason for this disagreement is a disagreement over the understanding of what constitutes personal circumstances. Now, the people argue that in analyzing a rational decision, you need to consider all of the personal circumstances at issue of the defendant. And that also includes prior convictions. Now, specifically, if we look to the eligibility if Ms. Rivas-Landa had not entered the plea in this case, we know that she already would have been admissible. We know that she already would have been deportable. So under the prejudice prong, the only question is, would it have changed her status in terms of being eligible for discretionary relief? Again, this can't form the basis for deficient performance, but it can be a consideration under the prejudice prong of Strickland. So if we look to the prejudice prong, in order to be eligible for discretionary relief under 1229B sub B, she would have to have never been convicted of a crime of moral turpitude. Here, the people argue that her prior conviction for criminal possession of a financial device was a crime of moral turpitude.
Do you have authority for that?
Your Honor, this has never been addressed, and that's largely because the crime of moral turpitude is purely a federal distinction. It's not a state law distinction, and that's largely because of the preemption in the field of immigration law. Our legislature cannot define what is a crime of moral turpitude.
But do you have any authority from any other jurisdiction that the financial device is a violation or effectively a moral turpitude?
Well, we have two cases to compare. If you look to the Third Circuit's determination in De Leon Reynoso, which refers to theft by receiving, and then if you also analyze the case cited by the defense, which is a matter of Cerna, which referenced criminal possession of identity documents, we compare the distinctions here and recognize that criminal possession of a financial device more clearly represents theft by receiving, which is a crime of moral turpitude. Specifically, if you look to footnote 10 of Cerna, it references that possession of stolen goods or mail with knowledge that they're stolen is a crime of moral turpitude because it's inherently wrong to deprive another person of his or her property by theft. And it is also wrong to perpetuate the harm already inflicted by continuing to possess goods which are known or should be known to be stolen. Here, we have a knowing element in the statute. It requires that in order to possess the financial device, which again, this is different than the identity documents, that is a separate statute in Colorado. It is not included in the definition here, so it's not merely possessing a Social Security card. It is instead possessing bank cards, credit cards, some type of equivalent. By possessing that financial device of another, an individual knows or should know that it has been lost, stolen, or delivered by mistake. But if we also look to Colorado's principles of criminal culpability under 18.1501, we see that this also requires a voluntary act. And when we look to voluntary acts in Colorado, specifically to possession, voluntary act means an act performed consciously as a result of effort or determination and includes the possession of property if the actor was aware of his or her physical possession or control thereof for a sufficient period of time to have been able to terminate it. The concern in whether a case is actually a crime of moral turpitude, as explained in De Leon Reynoso, is whether it also criminalizes mere negligent possession. Our statute doesn't. We don't have a specific intent to defraud, but we do have a knowing element. We look to our principles of criminal culpability, which require a voluntary act, and it tells us that this does not criminalize negligent possession. So what we have in this case is that Ms. Rivas-Landa's claim for deficient performance cannot be based on counsel's allegedly deficient performance in researching the eligibility for discretionary relief. That is not included in Padilla's mandate, and to include that would be a vast and unwarranted expansion of counsel's obligations.
Ms. Grande, let me come back to what you were saying a few minutes ago about whether or not there's a rational basis for Ms. Rivas Landa to have gone to trial as opposed to accepting a plea. Is that something that would be better answered after a hearing with a factual determination, or do you think that that's just a question of law that doesn't depend on the factual circumstances?
Your Honor, in certain cases, it may be more appropriate to remand for a hearing. However, in this case, it's a question of law, because the plea effectively had no impact on Ms. Rivas Landa's situation. The only impact it had was actually beneficial. If we look to Sassanon versus United States, one of the critical components in terms of rationality is whether a defendant received a substantial benefit in sentencing. Certainly, that's not the only consideration, but here, where the plea effectively had no effect because she was already ineligible, deportable, and not available for discretionary relief, she actually went from a 2 to 6 years in prison to instead serving 6 months probation. So it certainly does relate to rationality.
I see that your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Grundy.
I'm not asking the court to expand Padilla or Pozo. I'm asking the court to apply Padilla and Pozo. And both cases make it clear that discretionary relief is a relevant immigration factor that needs to be investigated and advised upon. If you accept the Attorney General's position and rule that counsel has no obligation to advise of discretionary relief, what you're essentially doing is ruling that defense attorneys have no obligation to a whole class of criminal defendants who are immigrants who have not been admitted. Because the only issue for an undocumented immigrant is whether or not they have discretionary relief in the immigration court, because we know that they're deportable on the basis that they're here without being documented, period. So there's no conviction that directly affects them. It's more of a case of, you know, does the conviction give them a way of defeating the removal proceedings and staying in the country? Also, I'm not arguing that defense attorneys have an obligation to review every conceivable immigration statute to see if there's any kind of remedy out there. This is straightforward. And an immigrant who is here without being admitted, the only way that they can stay in the country is to get some kind of discretionary relief to prevent that deportation. So that's all that counsel has to do, is go straight to discretionary relief. And Padilla and Pozo both talk about discretionary relief. Discretionary relief is a direct consequence because the conviction is the determiner. Does this conviction prevent discretionary relief, or does it have no impact on discretionary relief? So the conviction is the decider, and then does this person get to stay in the country, or is the person going to be deported? It's all based on this conviction. The Attorney General also made an argument that a defendant is not entitled to creative plea bargaining, but that's just contrary to what the United States Supreme Court says in Padilla. The United States Supreme Court specifically addresses that and says that with knowledge of the immigration consequences, a defense attorney can creatively plea bargain with the prosecution and come up with a plea bargain that avoids immigration consequences. So that's directly addressed in Padilla. On the personal circumstances, I mean, this is an easy question to answer, really. And all we have to do is look at this court's precedent in Kazadi. In Kazadi, he alleged in his petition for post-conviction relief that he came from the Congo. He came as a child with his parents. He'd lived in the country for a number of years. He was engaged to be married. His fiance was pregnant with his child. That was sufficient to establish that he could prove prejudice at an evidentiary hearing. It's the same kind of circumstances here. Miss Rivas Lander came to the country when she was 12 years old. She lived in the country for 15 years at the time that she pleaded guilty. She had 3 children, all United States citizens. Her entire family was in the United States, and she had no connection, no family, no friends in Mexico. So under those circumstances, you know, we can clearly establish prejudice at an evidentiary hearing. And then on the her prior conviction, possession of a financial device, again, we have clear authority that I cited in the reply brief, that possession of a financial device is not a crime involving moral turpitude. If it was, then that's a petition, post-conviction petition, that we would have filed at the same time that we filed this one. You know, I wouldn't do a piecemeal job on seeking post-conviction relief. If that was going to be a problem, there would be 2 petitions, one in each case. We could also be challenging that one. But it's not. It's not a crime involving moral turpitude. It's a safe immigration plea. And that's one thing that many defense attorneys do realize. It's one way of getting out of these theft convictions. And it may have been an option in this case, because the prosecution were only looking for a misdemeanor and probation, then the possession of a financial device plea, you know, would have satisfied that for the prosecution and then avoided immigration consequences. So I'd ask the court to remand this for an evidentiary hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Noble. Thank you again, Ms. Grundy. Thank you both for your excellent arguments in this case. We really appreciate them. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.